whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Sure. My name is Miriam Schoenfield. I teach philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. I work primarily in epistemology, the study of knowledge, but I focus a lot on rational beliefs. So thinking about what are the rational ways of responding to evidence, and also about what is sometimes called higher order evidence. So evidence about the rationality of our beliefs.
Well, I'm going to dive straight into the questions, and I think some of these issues in epistemology may come up later, but we'll get to them when we get to them. And I'm going to ask you an Iris Murdoch-inspired question. So she begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is certainly not self-expression, but she also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Well, I have to say, I was married to a psychiatrist for a long time, and he firmly believed of all of the philosophers he knew that their temperaments strongly influenced the philosophy that they did. So, in some sense, I'm inclined to defer to his expert opinion. But it's kind of a hard question to answer about myself. I guess insofar as my temperament has expressed itself philosophically is that probably just like a lot of philosophers, I find myself constantly very, very puzzled and just kind of bewildered by all of existence. The fact that there is existence, the fact that we are in it, the fact that there's consciousness, all of it is just, I find completely mystifying and bewildering. And so a lot of philosophy for me has just been trying in the smallest ways possible to make sense of all of this. And because it's very difficult, I think a lot of what I've been drawn to is sort of making sense of how difficult it is to make sense of things. And that's kind of how I ended up in epistemology.
I mean, have you always been puzzled and bewildered? Is that something that was a hallmark of your childhood, or was that something that you sort of acquired later in life?
Say that I've, for a very long time, including much of my childhood, I felt puzzled and bewildered. I grew up in a very religious environment. And, you know, you might think in some ways there would be less puzzlement because, you know, I was given a sort of complete theory of the world and told that this is how it was, but it was a very bewildering theory. So I constantly found myself bumping into parts of the picture that were difficult to understand and puzzled me.
Well, I think I'm going to ask you in one way or another some more about your childhood and growing up. But before I do that, I want to make sure I don't forget to ask, what was Aaron's theory about your temperament and how it influenced your philosophy? Did he have a take on you?
Can I cheat? Because actually an hour ago, I texted him.
Yeah.
And I literally just got a response. And he wrote.
Okay, great. This is live input.
Live input from the experts. He says, the answer is definitely yes. So that's into the question about whether my temperament has influenced my philosophy. And then he proceeds to say, and I have no idea how to describe it. So I guess that was less helpful than one might have hoped.
Okay. I was geared up for some incredible revelation there, but instead it was the classic psychiatrist. How do you think your temperament influences
exactly
your philosophical work? I see. Okay. Well, that didn't help us except that it confirmed the theory that it didn't in some way or other. So maybe I'll ask the second question, and then we can sort of talk about these two together. Because the second question is, has philosophy ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in your life?
So the answer to that, I would say, is yes. And again, primarily focused in epistemology. So this isn't exactly a practical difficulty, but because I always found myself so puzzled, there were times at which I felt almost paralyzed by not having a sense of what this whole thing I was involved in, the world, was all about. And there were times when I just felt like I didn't know how to make choices or even direct my inquiry when I was so in the dark about what the world was like. And the way that philosophy has helped me, it's ironic in a certain way, I've kind of become convinced through the work I've done in epistemology that there are actually very few constraints, is the way I would put it, on how to believe rationally or how to believe reasonably. So it's really, I've come to think, just a free-for-all. There's really not much you can do. And so I kind of gave up and just started letting my beliefs be whatever they were. I just, you know, there was a very specific moment I remember when I was like first kind of toying with this psychologically. And there was some article in the news about how there was a cloud of dust from the Sahara Desert that was going to be coming over Austin. And I looked up at the sky and it was kind of cloudy. And I remember thinking, oh, that would be so cool if that was the dust from the Sahara Desert. And then I just thought, okay, I'm going to believe that that was the dust from the Sahara Desert. And that was full of delight. And that's sort of just a lot of moments like that where I've kind of just loosened up on trying to sort of figure out the world in some very deliberate and rigorous way and just accepting that there's really not much to do other than just believe whatever we believe.
So you grew up Orthodox Jewish, is that right? That was your religious background.
Yes, I grew up in a Hasidic community.
And does this sort of sense that, as you say, it's a free-for-all, has that made you more sympathetic to the idea of sort of just opting in to an elaborate framework for seeing the world that might not seem persuasive or even intelligible to someone outside of it? Like, how do you feel about that kind of religious outlook looking back on it now?
Absolutely. So I have a lot of sympathy to people that partake in elaborate ways of looking at the world that seem unintelligible from the outside. And in fact, some of what was motivating me in some of this was, you know, I grew up in that community and I ended up not being convinced by the framework that was presented. And so I left. But, you know, I was very close to many people in the community. And I really had this sense that they shouldn't be giving up their beliefs. I should be giving up my beliefs because they kind of didn't stick. But something about the way they engaged with it seemed right. But it was also kind of difficult for me to make sense of what felt right about it, given that I thought that it was completely wrongheaded, the whole system. But now, yeah, when I look at it from the outside, I feel a kind of awe. They have a whole way of seeing the world, and it's distinctive, and like you said, it's elaborate, it's complex, it's full of richness, and I kind of celebrate that there are people seeing the world that way.
I mean, it seems like a really distinctive, maybe unusual kind of religious intellectual rebellion, not to say this is wrong, none of us should believe it, but to say, well, I can't believe this, and maybe I shouldn't believe it, but you should. I mean, was that your attitude all along? Was even when you were sort of losing your own religious convictions, did you all along think still people who think that are being perfectly reasonable?
No. When I left, I thought that I had seen the light and that they were being completely unreasonable. So it was only after having gotten some distance from it and continuing to have in-depth conversations with people in the community about their beliefs that I started feeling differently about it. One of the things that was very striking to me is that, you know, when I was leaving the community, I had lots and lots of religious debates with friends, family, rabbis of all, you know, rabbis who specialized in teenagers that were leaving the community and all of it. And, you know, nobody seems convinced by my arguments against the religion, not at all. However, one thing that really did disturb at least two people who I spoke to was this worry that they would have believed something different if they'd grown up in a different environment. So, you know, the knowledge that they only have this very elaborate particular system of belief because of the way they were raised, that really was disturbing to people, to the point that one of my friends who I talked to about this just said, please don't ever bring this up with me again. And that was interesting to me because I remember thinking, that's not the thing that should be, that's not the thing that should be worrying. Something about the fact that that's what was worrying to them didn't strike me as right. And so anyway, a lot of my thoughts in epistemology, I've just been heavily gripped by the idea that this kind of concern can be so powerful for people, even when sort of on a first order level, everything that they believe seems perfectly intact.
Yeah, no, it's interesting how tightly that connects with the kinds of issues about arbitrariness that you've gone on to work on in epistemology. I mean, I also want to go back to I love the idea of the rabbis who specialize in teenage intellectual rebellion. Like that's a sort of a special course you can take in rabbinical school to prepare yourself for teenagers like Miriam. I mean, what was the timeline? So was it when you went to college that you were sort of losing your religious convictions or yeah, when did the sort of break happen?
Well, no, I wouldn't have gone away to college had I kept my religious convictions because that wasn't a thing that was done. So it was while I was in high school, around the age of 16, I started having doubts. And I spent about a year under the assumption that something was very wrong with me. And that was the reason I was having these doubts. And so, you know, I tried to do all the spiritual things I could think of to get rid of them. And then there was a very distinctive moment at a traffic light when there was a sort of gestalt shift. And it occurred to me that actually maybe the views that I believed, that I had previously believed were wrong. And then that's when I decided, well, anyway, a few months after that, I decided that I would leave the community, and then I, you know, figured out how to get to college and go through that whole process.
Well, you couldn't script it better, that the traffic light was the place where the, you know, the dramatic change happened and you went from red to green or green to red or whatever the right metaphor is.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you for the next question about changing your mind. And now I think we've talked a lot about changes of mind. So even if you were going to talk about something else, I'm not going to ask you that question. Instead, I'm going to swerve away from serious spiritual issues to ask you this. Could you tell us about a hobby or something you love that you're embarrassed to admit?
Yeah, I suppose I could. So this is a relatively recent hobby / something I love, I would say. But over the past couple years, especially, you know, during the course of the pandemic, I've spent lots and lots of time alone in nature. And I have found that I enjoy and benefit from talking philosophy out loud to the trees or the birds or whoever happens to be listening when I'm roaming around. When I work with graduate students, I sometimes run these workshops for graduate students on sort of dealing with the difficulties of intellectual work, and specifically creative intellectual work. And I always emphasize how helpful it is to talk to other people when you're working. And, you know, I was being out in the wilderness alone for so long, that just wasn't available to me. And I discovered it didn't really have to be other people. It was just the talking. So that's something I do. And well, I'm somewhat embarrassed about, I guess, in that it seems unconventional.
Well, I love it. I mean, there must have been times when you were talking to yourself outside and you suddenly discovered that there was someone else around.
Well, I very much tried to avoid that situation because I thought that would be the most embarrassing thing in the world. It may have happened like once or twice, but usually like I'd go out like really early in the morning, or I'd just go out sort of off the path far away somewhere where I was pretty sure I wouldn't encounter anybody.
I see. I mean, on the plus side, you would have given them a story if as they were hiking, they walked past someone intoning some kind of philosophical mantra about, you know, higher order evidence or deferring to doubt or something. I mean, I don't know if this question is going to make sense, but can you describe you're not talking to a person, so there's no response, but you're talking. Can you say something about what that experience is like and how it informs your thinking? Like, why is that helpful and how does it change or affect your thinking in ways that are productive for you?
Don't know is the short answer to that question. It's something I've wondered about. One thing I think is that the intellect just does kind of work differently when it's in a communicative mindset, when it's sort of outwardly directed. And, you know, I noticed that, and other philosophers I have spoken to say the same thing, is, you know, sometimes, you know, you'll write a philosophical email to someone, to a friend or a colleague or an advisor, say, here's this thing I'm really confused about. And then by the time you've finished writing the email, you're no longer confused and you don't have to send the email. And there's just something about thinking with the aim of communicating that I think sometimes brings a kind of clarity or a kind of order. And the actual response of the other party is often the less important part. In fact, since we're talking about Aaron, you know, sometimes, yeah, Aaron, who's not a professional philosopher, someone I used to talk to all the time about philosophy, and I'd go on and he would say nothing but nod his head. And at the end, I would say that was extremely helpful. And he would say, I'm glad. And that was that. So I don't really know how it works, but it does seem to work.
Well, that sounds like his psychiatrist training coming in again. Is just, yeah, you know, just being a good listener. I mean, well, yeah. I'm going to ask you question four, which is back to serious issues about philosophy in a way. I'm going to ask what you hope for from philosophy in the next 20 years, although maybe part of the answer is for more people to spend time in nature talking philosophy into the void. I mean, that's this could really catch on.
The next APA conference is going to be like in some national park somewhere, and all the philosophers are just going to be dispersed talking into the void.
It sounds much better than the actual APA, I have to say.
What do I hope for philosophy in the next 20 years? You know, I really, the word hope feels kind of strong to me, because in the sense that I wouldn't want to sort of like make a wish that I thought would actually be actualized, because I kind of trust the process of intellectual development and I sort of wouldn't want it to be interfered with. But I will say that I have a kind of craving for philosophy over the next 20 years. And that is, it's very hard for me to articulate exactly what it is, but the closest thing I can think of is something like that it become like a little juicier. Like, I feel like analytic philosophy has gotten, well, not gotten, in some sense, it's designed around a kind of rigor that can sometimes feel a little dry. And so much emphasis has been placed on distinguishing analytic philosophy from other philosophical traditions, like, say, continental philosophy, which are more poetic and aesthetically informed. But sometimes I wish that we like had just, I don't know, like a little bit more flavor and beauty and poetry and, I don't know, something a little more like that in the way we do philosophy.
I share that hope or craving. It's interesting to me in part because I just taught ProSem, which is the first year course at MIT, which begins with the architects of what's now thought of as analytic philosophy. So Frege, Bertrand Russell, we did some Frank Ramsey, we did Wittgenstein's Tractatus. And while there is a certain kind of dry and desiccating quality to their approach, actually, it also does have an immense poetry to it. Like the scale and sort of the sense that your entire conception of the world is being transformed is really palpable, I think. And so in a way, it's not inconsistent with the rigor of analytic philosophy to have this sort of poetic, visionary quality. I mean, are there contemporary or recent works in philosophy that you think point in the direction that you would like philosophy to go?
There is a recent paper by Daniela Dover, and it was about, I'm probably not going to get it quite right, but it was about curiosity as a form of love. And in a way, the content isn't so important. It was just, I found the piece so beautiful. And yeah, illuminating and kind of like, kind of giving you like a different picture, a different vision for how to think about certain things. So I have encountered that. So yeah, I loved that. So I think I agree with you. I don't think it's inconceivable, though I do think in some ways the piece was straying from some of the tenets of analytic philosophy. You know, there were quotes. Well, your work has this too, quotes from literature and various things like that. So I don't know. It's hard to say exactly what analytic philosophy is and what it means to stray from it. But I guess I do see some things here and there where it kind of, that's kind of what elicits the craving. I'm like, oh yes, can we have more of that?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, I totally agree about Daniela Dover. There was another paper by her about conversation that I thought was just really beautiful. Yeah, also inspiring. I'm going to swerve now to the final question from hopes for positive things to fear. So this is another Murdoch-inspired question. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote. What is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
Well, I will try to give an answer to that question, but I am kind of very intrigued by the question. And I'm wondering if, knowing more Murdoch than I do, maybe you could say a little something about it.
I think it comes from a place that you might have views about, because it's not a million miles from the concern about irrelevant influences on belief. So she's defending the reality of the good, and she's worried about her own motivations, whether she's actually got good arguments or whether she's just afraid of a certain kind of nihilism or fragmentation of value. And she floats the general hypothesis that when you look at a philosopher, it's always useful to ask, what is this person afraid of? What kind of fears might be driving their work that would constitute irrelevant influences on belief that would make you suspicious? I think it is the kind of question that connects with your epistemology.
Interesting. Right. So her thought is that there's a kind of fear that's motivating people's intellectual trajectories.
Or at least that's her fear. Yeah.
that's her fear. Yeah. Okay.
You're now worried about whether the answer you are going to give to what you're afraid of reveals some terrible influence on your philosophy.
Yeah, so I guess to say I am kind of like, maybe I'm now corrupted. Well, I'll tell you the truth of what I'm thinking right now, which is just that, which is that I think if someone were going to tell a story like that about me and say like, oh, this is what Miriam is afraid of, and this is what's driven her whole picture in epistemology, it would be something like a fear of getting it wrong, because so much of what I end up defending is that there's sort of so few rules for how to believe and how to live, and that makes it easy to do things right in a certain way. So one might say that there is a fear of doing things wrong, which results in a sort of insistence that there be so few ways to mess up. So anyway, I think that's the story that one would tell about what one would tell about me. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what came to mind.
Well, can I ask a question about it that I think draws on a distinction that you make in some of your work, which is the distinction between getting it wrong in the sense of having a false view, getting the facts wrong, and getting it wrong in the sense of being irrational, a kind of influence making you irrational. Because it seems like the fear that your epistemological picture addresses is the fear of being irrational, the fear that you've somehow violated the norms, you're not thinking well. It doesn't save you from the fear of getting it wrong. I mean, you could still be wrong, or is that not how you think about it?
No, it absolutely is how I think about it. Yeah. And actually, before I asked you about the question, my answer probably would have been that one of my biggest fears is getting it wrong in the sense of not ending up really making contact with reality, not sort of getting it, not really getting what the world is like, and sort of, yeah, dying before one has had a chance to fully comprehend it. So yeah, I think that is a very real fear for me, and I think certainly something that can happen to all of us. So yeah, the only sense in which there's liberation is that there isn't really, in my opinion, a right way to go about trying to get it right. So I mean, in some ways it sounds optimistic, but in other ways it's quite devastating, because there's this thing that I and many other people deeply want, which is to really know the world. And a lot of my philosophical views say, well, good luck.
Okay, we'll end with good luck. And I'll say thank you, Miriam, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you, Kieran.
Miriam Schoenfeld is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Texas, Austin. She's the author of Decision-Making in the Face of Parity, Meditations on Beliefs Formed Arbitrarily, and other essays in epistemology and ethics. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.